Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today we are honored to have with us Judge Ginger Lerner Wren, author of an important new book titled A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court. Welcome, Judge Wren.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's such a joy to be on your show.
Well, it's a joy to have you. In 1997, Judge Lerner Wren, along with a number of other people in Broward County, Florida, started America's first mental health court. And they did this for numerous reasons, including the fact that they were profoundly troubled by the fact of a revolving door of people with mental illness in their courtroom, as well as the fact that so many people in Broward County, as throughout the rest of the United States, were basically criminalized for manifesting the symptoms of their mental illness. So with that in mind, Judge Lerner Wren, please tell our listeners, what is a mental health court? Who is eligible for a mental health court? And what is the benefit for the accused to be on a mental health court docket?
Thank you, Elizabeth. I will. And, you know, first of all, I just want to say on behalf of my community, you know, we're so grateful, number one, for having this opportunity. But, you know, it's just a perfect time to be on your show. This month happens to be the court's 22nd anniversary. And, you know, for 22 years, we have had just an amazing collaborative of mental health and criminal justice stakeholders. I really always say we're the greatest collaborative on this planet with an abiding belief in recovery. And the court, you know, was established, as you said, you know, really as a human rights strategy. What is the problem that we wanted to solve? And the problem, as you so well stated, was the fact that so many people were getting arrested due to untreated mental illness, undertreated mental illness, largely because they could not access care. You know, Florida is the third largest state in the United States. We have a very diverse population. We have no Medicaid expansion. We are chronically underfunded. And, you know, so many of our families, you know, were suffering. They just, you know, were looking for help, and they were looking for some judge, some way, some strategy in the court system to really transform what was happening. And we were very, very lucky. We just happened to hit a poignant moment in time where I think our community's consciousness truly became awakened. And so together with a task force with no money, no funding, we realized that we just have to take a leap of faith. We have to do something to create a diversionary mechanism to use the court process to literally take people out of an inappropriate system, being the jail system, when they're ill, and move them into a more appropriate system of care. And that would, of course, would be the community-based system of care. And for people that were being arrested that were acutely ill, well, of course, you know, we were able to have people transported to local acute care facilities, and then we don't have any authority to commit from the court, but of course, at least they'd be cared for, they'd come back, and then we would work toward getting them services in the community, whatever people needed. And it's a voluntary court, so our centerpiece of the court is really about dignity and really diversion. And I think that the idea that who are we holding accountable in the court, a lot of these problem-solving courts, as they should be, you know, focus around accountability. Our accountability really is holding the system of care accountable to the people and to the families that it is intended to serve.
Judge, you said so much, and there is so much I want to follow up on. First of all, you use the phrase diversionary court, which leads to the question, although people are on your docket are placed in the appropriate services or obtain the appropriate services within the community, what happens to their underlying criminal charge?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because in the early years, most of the charges used to be dismissed. Now they tend not to be dismissed unless the case is or unless somebody's found incompetent to proceed, because we can do anybody in any status. But largely, we're not really focused on the charges, and when individuals demonstrate that either they have services already, they're linked, maybe they just had some kind of a problem and we don't even really need to get engaged. We're happy to resolve their case if they want with just what's called a minimal plea offer of a withholding of adjudication, and really that's okay. It, just giving them credit. Or Certainly, if we need to just help individuals over a short period of time to get access because their needs are complex, or if there are public safety concerns, you know, we might hang on to a case a little bit longer. But our goal is, I guess, less focused on the case than it is on the diversion and getting people the help that they need.
Understand. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly, and we are talking with Judge Ginger Lerner-Wren, the author of an important and compelling new book titled A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court. Now, Judge Lerner-Wren, you mentioned a few moments ago that your court is celebrating 22 years of operation. Huge congratulations.
Thank you.
It's
unbelievable, really.
How many mental health courts are there in the United States at this point?
That's a great question. You know, I really think they're not really necessarily accounting like they used to many years ago, because there's hundreds and hundreds of mental health courts, not only in the United States, but there's also hybrid behavioral health courts, meaning integrated with, of course, substance use disorders. And the mental health courts were the springboard for veterans courts. And these courts, particularly Broward's model, which is a human rights framework, are very, very popular in the UK and on a global level. So it's really hard to say. It's an extremely popular model, I mean, largely because if you have a strong collaborative, you really can do these courts in a very cost-effective way. We've never had any grants. We've never had any funding, really.
Interesting. Now, you used the phrase or the word a few moments ago, dignity. And in fact, the word dignity appears throughout your book. Why is that concept so important to you?
It is. You know, I think certainly when we first started the court, Elizabeth, I have to tell you, I was new to the bench. I was only a judge for maybe about 5 months, but I was asked to establish this court because I came to the bench with very unique and specialized skill sets. I'm a former PAMI lawyer from our disability rights P&A in Florida. I am a former public guardian. I was overseeing a federal class action consent decree implementation that really centered on discharge planning and reintegration in the community. So I was really specially trained by a truly visionary expert team. But I think that when I started the court, we never did this before. There was no roadmap. And I think that at the very least, I thought to myself that if the court, if all of those complicated components of the court, I mean, we had to go across county, across system, across agency to have all of our providers literally change their service models for us to empower this court. And I just, if nothing else, I thought, you know, respect and dignity and promoting the personhood of the people that we were seeing, if nothing else, we really wanted to create this court that was a refuge and that was promoting humanism and that dignity. You know, we knew that dignity had to be the centerpiece of the court because we really wanted to take aim, you know, at stigma, at the marginalization, at the trauma. And through dignity, we were really able to, you know, level the playing field of the court. And so many times, you know, we know that individuals that are going into a criminal court or even a civil court or maybe an involuntary civil commitment process, you know, there's just all these, if you will, you know, these hidden prejudices. And that there's winks and there's laughter. And, you know, I just really wanted to create a space, a culture where dignity, you know, was paramount. And so that's why I think, you know, from that vantage point, that's how through storytelling, through the application of therapeutic jurisprudence, and the idea of really validating the idea that treatment works and recovery is real, that power of dignity combined with hope and an abiding belief in recovery, you know, it's just miracles happen.
And that raises the question, how did we get to this point? That is to say, depending upon what statistics you read, half of the people in our jails and our prisons have some type of mental disability, whether it's a mental illness or an intellectual/developmental disability.
Yes.
Why have our jails and our prisons become de facto mental institutions?
You know, we know the story. I think that largely, you know, the failed deinstitutionalization process that was being championed during the 60s, you know, and the vision that President Kennedy had, you know, really wanting to create a new blueprint, you know, of community based care in America. You know, unfortunately, when the Mental Health Act, you know, of 1963 was signed, a month later, you know, tragically, President Kennedy was assassinated, and again, you know, we had this vacuum of leadership, and, you know, sadly, with all of the civil rights litigation that was going on during the 60s, So many advocates, for example, really felt that we had reached a turning point when, in fact, that vacuum of leadership only really turned out to be have such a counterintuitive impact when state hospitals that were largely, we know, they were warehouses, they were snake pits. We know that. The hospital I oversaw, through a federal class action, I think I was so traumatized at that work, I had to do something, like the mental health court, I think, just to heal myself. But largely, you know, people were just ending up on this, getting discharged on, and with the bed reductions and shortages, and the community based system of care just really never. Appear. And so individuals were ending up homeless, chronically homeless, and again, or endlessly revolving, you know, through emergency rooms and jails and homeless shelters and or worse. And so You know, our policymakers have yet, I think, to really step up, if you will, and have their awakening, like our community had our awakening, you know, that there is no health without mental health, and that
treatment works,
and recovery is real. And I really believe, you know, that we're moving, I think, in a positive direction as we move toward integration, as we talk about prevention, as we understand about the impact of adverse childhood experiences, that we hear all of these celebrities, you know, talk about and share their stories. I think there was in the news, I think I just read, there was a recent survey, you know, that stigma surrounding mental health, mental illnesses, you know, is starting to wane. But, you know, I think, for example, I love doing the mental health court. Nothing gives me, you know, as great of joy as to deliver justice in such a real way. And yet we know that...
Judge, we need to wrap up. So I'm going to ask you a final question, and we only have about a minute left. You used the phrase a moment ago, nothing brings you more joy than presiding over your mental health court docket. And we so respect that. But at the same time, we all know that secondary trauma is real, that burnout is real. How
it is.
Do you keep yourself healthy? What makes you
come back
day after day after day and do this work?
Thank you. You know, just my passion, Elizabeth, just the passion and the absolute dedication that I have. You know, every single person we get out of jail, I think of it like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life and you hear the bell ring. You know, I just, I love it. And it really, you know, I just keep focused on all the people that we're able to help. And that is enough for me.
All right, that will have to be the last word. Thank you so much, Judge Ginger Lerner-Wren, for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
And thank you to all of my listeners. You've been listening to Author Chats. We've been joined by Judge Ginger Lerner-Wren of the Broward County, Florida Mental Health Court, and she discussed her new book, A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. Have a good day.